Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And our special guest today is an actor who plays a fantastic role in this minute of the movie, Lex Shrapnel, which is the coolest name I've heard in a long, long time.
Amen to that.
We'll talk to Lex about this role, his career, maybe his family, maybe even touch on his name. Welcome to the podcast, Lex.
Very good to be here. Very good to meet you guys.
Well, lovely to have you. Hal, what's happening in this minute?
Well, here we go with the synopsis of Minute 21 with a special guest doing his own lines.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. On the sun-scorched training grounds of Camp Lehigh, Gilmore Hodge, a brash recruit, sneers at Peggy Carter.
I thought I was signing up for the U.S. Army.
He says, his tone mocking. Peggy's eyes narrow, her voice calm but firm. What's your name, soldier?
Gilmore Hodge, Your Majesty.
He replies with a smirk. Step forward, Hodge. Put your right foot forward. Peggy orders, her posture unwavering. Hodge grins, leaning in.
We gonna wrestle? Because I got a few moves I know you'll like.
In a flash, Peggy's fist connects with his jaw, sending him sprawling into the dirt.
Thank you for that. That was fantastic.
Agent Carter, Colonel Phillips barks, striding onto the scene. Colonel Phillips, Peggy replies, unfazed, standing still. Phillips glances at the fallen recruit, a hint of approval in his eyes. I can see that you are breaking in the candidates. That's good. He turns to Hodge, his voice a whip crack. Now get your ass up out of that dirt and stand in that line of detention until somebody comes tells you what to do.
Yes, sir.
Hodge scrambles to his feet, chastened. Phillips surveys the recruits, his gaze lingering on Steve Rogers, small but resolute among the others. General Patton has said that wars are fought with weapons, but they are won by men. We are going to win this war because we have the best men, his eyes lock on Steve, and because they are going to get better, much better. The scene shifts to a grueling training montage, recruits sweating and straining under the relentless sun. Phillips' voice carries over the chaos. The Strategic Scientific Reserve is an allied effort, and scene.
Clap. Wild applause for that one. That was.
Listen, you did it. Your Tommy Lee Jones was better than my me, and your Haley Atwell was better than my me. So well done.
I'm not going to say what I'm about to say, which is I can't do me, but I could do Haley Atwell. No, that's not the kind of show this
pull over.
Is.
Let me. Yeah.
Yes. Beep, 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 Jim.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Well, Lex, thanks so much for being part of the show. I've been looking forward to this for a while, and we always worry when we send out these emails to different people that were involved in the production. It's like, oh, please say yes, because I know this would be a great episode. So thank you for being part of this. Before we get into all of the production of this thing, I started reading about you. I started with IMDb, and I wound up in Wikipedia, and then I wound up on your long family tree. And your family being, turning into a common noun. This is like meeting a Bill Donut or something. You have such a fascinating family history. I mean, going back to different, you obviously come from a long line of acting and acting adjacent families. Can we go into a little bit about that? If that's okay.
To, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I love your grandma.
Amen to that.
Yeah, for our listeners, Deborah Carr is Lex's grandmother, and your dad was in so many different productions. I mean, he was everywhere, and then going back further in time, you've had journalists, people that were basically theater critics and things like that. So I guess you're kind of destined here, either destined to do this or winding up with Royal Ordnance and building new and magnificent ways of munitions.
I wouldn't go down that path myself, but it is that history is there.
I'm supposed people ask you about that all the time. It must be exhausting. Mm-hmm. It's just, oh, really? Where's the, you know, is that your stage name? It's like, no, that's your...
I really thought you were like a punk rocker who had picked like a Sid Vicious kind of thing. But your name is your name, Lex Shrapnel. And
it's my name. You're not named... Lex is an abbreviation of Alexander. Yeah. Yeah. But my brothers are Joe and Tom, so my parents called me Lex. And
it's, but Shrapnel is named after you, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. So Henry Shrapnel, who was my ancestor, he was a general in the military and an inventor, and he invented the exploding shell, which was used in the Napoleonic Wars, Battle of Waterloo, and is now why you see it, sadly, on a daily basis in the newspapers with a, you know, with a lowercase s.
But, yeah. No, it's fascinating. I used to work for the Royal Ordnance Division of British Aerospace, and I feel like, so we're part of the same family business, I guess.
Yeah.
But but anyway, let's get back to speaking of wars and things. We're here in this movie about World War II or adjacent World War II. Can you tell us where your first intersection was with Captain America? How did you wind up? I'm assuming you get a call from your agents, like, get over there and do an audition, or how did that all work out?
Yeah, I was doing a play. I was in Leeds, in the north of England, and I was doing a play up there, doing Death of a Salesman, so playing American in that. And the audition came up, and I was very excited about it. Priscilla John, who cast it, is one of the great casting directors and has always been a sort of great champion of mine. And you know, when you're starting out, that's what you need. You need someone who's really behind you. And so when the message came via the agent from her, I think they wanted me to come in, but I couldn't do that. And at that point in time, you know, the self-tape wasn't as prevalent as it is now. It's the norm now, and it wasn't then. So I had to scramble to get a camera that was sort of good enough to film the scenes. I had to find someone to read opposite me. And I seem to remember having to contact the agent saying, look, should I send the actual tape, the hard tape, rather than email, downloading an email? Like, I had no idea. The process was not experienced in that way of auditioning, but did it. And as is often the case with projects that are this big, it took a long time to hear back, so you sort of forget about it. And then it came good, and I was thrilled to be a part of it. And having grown up, you know, I'm not a big comic guy growing up, but there was this, I think it was in the 70s, there was a TV movie of Captain America, which for some reason really stayed with me. I loved it. It was something about the colors and you know, as a kid, the idea of America, Captain America, and really stayed with me, and that was the sort of character I knew most, and the idea of being in this new film of it was obviously hugely, hugely exciting.
I'm curious if they asked you to do an American accent for your audition, because you do one in the film that's just delightful. And I assume you had a dialect coach and so forth, but when you auditioned, did they want to hear what you sounded like?
Funnily enough, the first audition, they wanted English military accent. So a sort of cut English sort of RP. And then they came back and wanted the American audition. And as I say, I was doing Death of a Salesman, so I was pretty comfortable with the accent. I was doing it every day for the show. And I've always sort of felt confident with American. There's something about the accent, the physicality that comes with it, that I felt comfortable with. And I've always wondered why. My mother was born in America, although she only ever sounded American when she was talking to her stepfather, who was very Californian sounding. But there was something about, just through going through films, through this step grandfather, I was, the American accent just felt natural to me, and a really good way of what I find very difficult is playing parts that are too close to you. It's easier to find an accent. I find that mask of an accent, that physicality, I find extremely useful, and very much so with Gilmore Hodge, you know.
Well, your accent with Gilmore was fantastic because it's not just American. It's not what we'd call standard newscaster talk. You tie him to a place and a time that's just,
Good.
yeah, real, well done.
Thank you.
These guys have heard me. These guys have heard me talk about this before. You'll hear it again on this show, but it fascinates me how it seems to be sort of a one-way street. There's not a lot of American actors who can do, you know, credible English accents of any form or any type. I'm not saying they're not there. It's just, it's rare, but there's something about actors from the UK who can convince us so immediately. I think pay attention to these things, and I never would have thought that you were anything other than what you sounded like.
Oh, that's encouraging to hear. But I think we are so exposed to American movies growing up, you know, because I think Australians are the same. They're fantastic at American accents. And I think we are so exposed to American cinema from a formative age, you know, and so our idea of and you embed it, you know, those childhood movies that you watch. Even as far back when I was very young, I was obsessed with The Wizard of Oz. And my mom says that there was a period of about 6 months where I watched it almost once a day. And so that's at that age. And that's, you know, a very American movie. And I guess it just continues. And then I guess a lot of, if that's what you want to do, a lot of film, it's the accent you've got to nail early on, I think.
I was thinking, you know, one of the things we were talking about before we started the show was that you were in the live action version of Gerry Anderson's Thunderbirds, and I keep thinking so many kids in Britain were exposed to American accents through puppets, right? Because Gerry Anderson hired American voice actors, or you know, emigre Americans that were there, so that you wound up sounding like the Thunderbirds, because that was the American accent they were trying to sell back to an American audience.
Yeah. And all named after what, Mercury astronauts, correct?
Yeah,
John,
that's
Virgil,
right. Yeah.
Et cetera.
Yeah. So, anyway, continuing on with the show, now when you went back, you get the job, you book it and you're all set, and you go to, I think were they filming it in Shepparton, or I don't know where.
They filmed a lot there. I think, as my memory serves, I think a lot of that sequence was filmed in a back lot at Pinewood.
At Pinewood, okay.
There was a big, the thing is with that sequence, it was shot over such a long period of time and in a few different places, ending up doing a reshoot in just outside LA almost a year later.
Wow.
Now, I know you have this scene that highlights you, but are you in all the other scenes of the men working out and doing the exercises and getting tested and so forth?
Yeah.
You're in there too.
So in with all of that, and then this reshoot, well, it wasn't a reshoot, it was just some additional stuff to kind of create the climax of that scene, which is me trying to climb up the flagpole, I think racing up to climb the flagpole, which I can't get up. And Steve Rogers just, what does he do? He pulls the pin out. Simple as that. So it's because you'd already had me hiding from the grenade. You'd already had acts of stupidity and cowardice on my part. And I think they just needed one more to really hammer it home.
But you were that close to being the super soldier, man. It could have been you.
Right.
Buddy, I live with that every day. It could have been me. I've had this idea of what happened to Gilmore Hodge, you know, because he lives with that every day.
Yeah,
and I was thinking, there's got to be a spin-off, and you call it Unhappy Gilmore, and, and it's like you shoot it like a sort of 60s kind of, you know, indie movie, like, or like Taxi Driver or something. But this really twist. Anyway, I'll try. I'll try and pitch that to Kevin.
Joe, on our first episode, Joe said he's looking for just one more feature to do before he retires. So, you know, I think it's worth an elevator pitch.
Unhappy Gilmore. I always pictured him going on like with a used car dealership or something like that, you know, Hodge Dodge or something.
Sounds about right.
Hodge Dodge Oldsmobile.
Right. gosh, yeah. No,
telling stories.
I was picturing he winds up like Biff in Back to the Future. It's like he's shining Cap's car out in the back, and just, you know, here's your shield back. I've waxed it, and you know, yeah. But
whatever it is, it's a pretty sad existence, yeah, I think, for the poor guy. And he, you know.
Well, we're joking about it, but you know, you're playing this role. I assume you've got to or want to find something redeemable in the man. Did you put yourself in his shoes to the extent you could?
Yeah, you do. I mean, I guess the purpose it serves within the film, all Hodge is doing, he's in that military environment, and he, sort of up to that, you know, he's a bit of a bully and whatever, but there is this kind of alpha thing. There is, and you know, they seem to be looking for that toughness, and actually what makes a good soldier and why Steve Rogers get it is you know, a morality and a humanity and a personal heroism. But you think if you're in that environment and to survive in that environment, then you're going to be the best. You're going to try and make yourself the best at what you think it is they want. And I guess that's what Gilmore Hodge thinks it is they want. I mean, I also figured he wasn't that bright. I would never deem to insult a character I played, but his actions were someone, you know.
Yeah. Well, in the comic book world, from what I'm not sure if you've seen this, but in Captain America, there's a 1991 series of Captain America where Gilmore Hodge came from. And what it turned out was once he was turned down for the role, he joined the Bund, the American Nazi Party, and was doing espionage. And Cap had to like capture him, and he wound up going to prison. They sent him to like Leavenworth or something. But it was a really rather long and involved story. And that was like a decade before the movie came out. So it's interesting so many characters in this movie that I didn't know were part of the comic book world that had come out.
I did not read that, which is shameful for the comic book expert to admit, but I didn't see it.
that would make a great spinoff. Maybe better than...
There we go. Secret Agent Hodge.
I just wish the audience could have seen Lex's face as you were recounting all that, Jim. That was sort of this... There was a journey of emotions. It's like, you know, oh, he becomes a Nazi. That's terrible, but... He has this interesting life of espionage, you say. You know, like, he was sort of imaginatively twirling his mustache just a little bit.
Yeah, mini Red Skull he was.
The joys of playing the villain.
I have to ask, the first day you're on set, I don't think they did did they do a table read? Did you have time for that? Or did you just like show up and...
I don't. They might have done with sort of other core cast, but I don't recall a table read. So I think that scene was my first actual day of filming. There was some training stuff, I remember, and but I think a lot of the training sequence was filmed after I'd done that scene, and that was my first time on set.
We've had fascinating discussions already with Joe Johnston and some of the special effects people at Lola, who did the skinny Steve Rogers effects, about the difficulties or challenges of shooting those scenes with skinny Steve and Chris Evans, and what was that like? What was that process?
It was a long process because you're filming it with Chris, and then you're filming it with skinny Steve, who was played by a wonderful actor called Leander Dini, who, if he weren't so good, it would have made it a lot harder. And he was absolutely brilliant at capturing what Chris was doing in his performance. So when I was playing opposite Leander, it was great. It was, you know, he couldn't have been better, and it would have been a much trickier process if that weren't the case. And if I remember rightly, I think there was also a third pass you had to do, because it was, I think they, there was a 3D version. So they had to do another. I could be making this up, it's quite possible, but I seem to remember there was always a third pass on a wide for 3D or something.
We were told that for the eye lines, like sometimes Chris Evans would act, but they would put like an eye line on his neck or down, you know, in the middle of his chest, so that that's where his eyes were down below. So just trying to get that, and so it must have been just take after take after take that you had to hit your mark every time, the same seconds. Did you get a chance when you were working with Haley? How many times did you rehearse the knockout?
Quite a few, I think, because also you see in the scene, it's quite a compact line of soldiers. So when you
when you're flicking your head. I mean, it'd be very easy to headbutt the guy, you know, the guy to my right. Or, but you also need to, you know, you've got to do it convincingly and throw yourself into it. So I think we did it quite a lot. But Haley, I adore Haley, and we did. I don't know that we'd met before working on the film, but we went to the same drama school, and we have a lot of mutual friends. And that immediately makes it easier because, you know, a set, particularly a set that big, is such an intimidating place, particularly on a day when you have so much, so many supporting artists, so much background work going on. So all the stuff behind you that's choreographed, that if you mess up your line, everyone's got to go back to number one. And it's on you. It's because you couldn't remember Gilmore Hodge, Your Majesty, or whatever it is you try on. And you're like, oh God, there's gonna be 750 people who know that you flunked it.
you don't want to be eight take shrapnel, they call it. Yeah,
exactly, mate. Exactly. You want to be one and done.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
But it helps know, you know, and knowing Haley, and we hit it off, and it just makes it that much easier to have things and people around you that are calming, you know, because it's very easy to, you can easily kind of get wound up and intimidated by what is understandably intimidating.
Did you find with her, actor to actor, that you kind of shared a language coming out of the same education, that you could had a little shorthand with her?
I think so. I do. And I think it's funny with the drama schools. I mean, I have to say, I think you learn possibly more from actually working, but the 2-3 years you spend at a drama school are so intense. And if you're there around a similar time, you tend to have the same teachers, the same practitioners there. So you're learning in the same way. So there is a sort of shared sensibility in a share, and you do feel, you know, you feel that, and you certainly feel that when you're doing theatre with actors from the same school.
Does it make it, I'm not sure where this was in your career as a as an entry point. You were much, you know, younger in here. So you're on set, and you know, right across from you is Tommy Lee Jones, and I try when we have different guests on. Like I'm trying not. When we have different guests on, it's hard not to be a little starstruck or being a little bit, you know. How do you? Do you ever have problems with that, or do you just work right through it? And it's like, here's somebody else I'm working with.
You are starstruck is the word. I mean, I find people like him so impressive. I'm such a film buff, and when you're with an actor like Tommy Lee Jones, you're picturing The Fugitive, you're picturing Rolling Thunder, and it's sort of incredible to be in the, you know, in the presence of someone whose career you've admired so much, and to have them staring at you and expecting you to bring your A game is intimidating. But I'd experienced it before. My first job out of drama school was a movie called K-19, The Widowmaker.
Oh, wow.
And that was with Harrison Ford, and it was directed by Kathryn Bigelow, who, again, like I grew up watching her movies, and when I got that, and when I met her for that, it was like meeting Spielberg for me, you know, and that was, and she's a formidable presence, and so that was intimidating. And then the first day on set of that, and you're looking at Harrison Ford, you're looking at a face that, you know, if you've grown up on Han Solo and Indiana Jones, it's a face I well as know as well as my parents, and you got him staring at you expecting you to bring your A game. You're like, oh God. So I think that was a good training ground for then, you know, a few years down the line, being there with Tommy Lee Jones, who was brilliant. And it's just fascinating to watch those actors and how they, the sort of confidence they have, and even if they fluff something or something doesn't happen in the right way, the way they navigate that, you know, your instinct, you mess it up, you feel awful, and you go, oh God, I'm sorry. And even, you know, even if he lost the line, I was watching him thinking, you can use any of that footage because he never breaks character. Someone might feed him the line, but he never breaks character. He might be thinking about
Am I gonna have a burger for dinner, or am I gonna have whatever it is you might be thinking?
Yes.
But it's so you can film that, and he knows that. He knows as long as he doesn't break it, they can use anything. And that's a great lesson as an actor, because your instinct is to go. If it goes wrong, you feel like it's gone wrong. Well, it hasn't gone wrong. It can carry on. It's just you
Yeah,
might need a line
keep
fed,
rolling.
or
Yeah,
you've got to
yeah.
keep rolling and find your way through it. And yeah, they don't seem to have that nervous quality that an actor of my, relative inexperience then had, and indeed sometimes still has. You have to
Well,
remind yourself of these things.
Tommy Lee Jones and Harrison Ford are not likely to get fired.
That's very true. That is
They're not going
very
to get
true. That is a
replaced.
good
Yeah.
point.
Yeah.
So the fear is justified. That's true.
Wow. Well, we've done in the past, we've done a couple of movies by minutes of Joe Johnston movies like October Sky and things like that, and The Rocketeer. A lot of people that we've talked to that have been directed by Joe Johnston said he only gives you the feedback that he usually gives you is negative, if anything, but it's not like if you're doing okay, just keep going. He's do you find that was his directorial style with you, that okay, let's go on to the next one, or
I think so. And I think, on a film with that, certainly on with scenes of that scale, he's thinking about so many different things that if he seems happy with what you've done and hasn't asked you to change anything, then he is happy with what you've done. But it's very, as an actor, you're always looking for sort of affirmation. You want to be told that you're doing all right, because
a pat
we're
on the
so
head will
prone
always
to
help.
say,
Yeah.
yeah, we're so prone to self-flagellation and doubt. But learn quickly with him. You get the sort of measure of someone and how they work, like directors can do with actors. And you could see how busy he was and how much he had to think about. And to be honest, most of the time, I don't fuss too much about what I'm doing. I trust that I've done the work going into it. I trust that I'm bringing something to the table, and I trust that a director will tell me to do it differently if it's not what they hoped it would be or what they think it could be. But I do think, like, a lot of the time I'll say to a director, if you're happy, I'm happy, and let's move on, because it's very easy to take a lot of time up, sort of, you want to be a perfectionist about it, but there are so many more moving parts in what it's going to take to complete that day that you can't indulge in it too much. And
You want to
I
be a
think a director of his caliber, if he's happy, then I'm happy,
and you want to be a perfectionist about your own work, but you're there to execute the director's vision, not necessarily to, to do this exactly the way you hoped to do it or wanted to do it.
Yeah,
So
that's it.
that's an interesting insight that, if they're happy, you're happy.
It is. It's what makes it very different from doing theatre, because film is a director's medium. You're there to serve that. On stage, what happens? You're working in a room for 4 or 6 weeks, but when you're up there, every night you'll be fine tuning and fine tuning, and something that went right the night before went badly tonight, and why did that happen? So you're sort of forced to be perfectionist about it and really keep fine-tuning it. Whereas in film, it's a lot of it is just cancel and continue. You do the scene. If they're happy, you are moving on, and don't lie in bed at night thinking about, why didn't I do that? Or
They'll fix it in the editing room. Yeah,
Yeah, exactly.
I was wondering, the we had a Marek Aurevic on earlier. He was the first guy that gets run over by the Red Skulls team, and he said that Joe came in one day and was talking with him and said, we're going to do the whole scene in Norwegian. And that was like, he'd just been reading all the sides and like, okay, I got to learn Norwegian today. But I was just
That's a
wondering,
big
was,
ask. That's a big
yeah,
ask.
more time, more screen time maybe. But I was wondering, were your scenes pretty much as you saw it on the page, or did he try alternate takes with you?
As I recall, it was pretty much as it was on the page. I'm not sure. Maybe Haley
ad-lib some stuff. But I think, again, I think because there was so much going on in the timing of a lot of those scenes and within those sequences, I don't think there was a lot of room for that. And I'm glad he didn't ask me to do it in another language. Or
If the accent was bad enough.
exactly.
Aside from the bit in LA, how long a shoot was it for you?
It kept dragging on. So I think the initial booking was 3 weeks, I think. And then there was another week added in, and then there was the LA shoot. So I think a lot of it was filming over the summer, and then in March the following year, March 2011, I flew out to LA and did just a couple of days. But it was a great excuse to be out there, because I do enjoy it out there. But
One of the things that Joe had mentioned was when they were making the movie, Kevin Feige kept coming back and said, "No, we need it bigger." And I think it sounds like some of those additional scenes that they were putting in there was just to make it bigger, make the obstacle courses harder and things like that. Were that was
And
the part that was added, I think.
I think you're right, and that's a sign of the brilliance of what he does, Kevin Feige. Because I mean, he's what was really interesting with the whole project, the whole being a part of that project, was seeing something. I can't remember where it sits, but it's definitely early on in what became the MCU. It's one
Yeah,
of the early ones.
the second one actually. It was just the
Is
second
it
film.
right?
So
Right,
you
right,
guys
right.
set up a whole bunch of things for, decades of more entertainment.
And I remember sort of knowing that that was the ambition. And it was really interesting to see people like Chris Evans at the start of this journey, Haley. It's really interesting to see that. And the stakes were extremely high. And I also remember thinking at the time, it's really bold to be doing a period film for this, to be setting it in the Second World War. And I love it for that. I think it still stands out because in a really positive way because of that. But that's such a bold and brave move when the stakes are that high, when that money's being spent. But when you've got someone overseeing the whole thing and the whole vision, like Kevin, I think he and clearly did know exactly what he was doing, and with asking for those reshoots, knew exactly what was needed.
And Joe has such a gift for period pieces anyway. You
The
look at
Rocketeer,
his
which I loved, and
Rocketeer and October Sky and his, so many others. Lex, can you tell us about your experience the first time you sat in a darkened room and saw the movie, saw the final cut?
with the it's such a long time from when you finish shooting to it coming out, and being, relatively small part of it, to see it all come together, to see, one's own stuff within the context of the whole story, and actually being pleased with what, the character sort of brought to the story and sort of kicked off the journey of Steve Rogers. But I was blown away by it, because there's a movie like that, so much happens in post-production. And the scale of it, I'd done movies like Thunderbirds and K-19 that were big films, but this definitely seemed on another level in terms of its huge scale and ambition. And it really blew me away. And everyone, I remember it was a screening that I guess Marvel had organized in London, and some mates obviously were there. From the production side and actors, I remember Haley was there, and I think everyone was really excited about it. And often that's not the case. Often you're very, it's not that the film's n not good, but you often have disappointments because you know what the potential was in scenes that you've been in, and you think, if it was cut differently, or if why did they use that, or indeed whether your stuff is just excised altogether from the film, which does
Yes,
happen.
indeed.
So you go, I mean, there's always that risk when you go into a screening, and it was certainly the case with this. Actually, it's why I was saying it was so pleasing to see how you know, the purpose Hodge, Gilmore Hodge serves within the film, because I was just thinking, oh, a film of that scale, what's going to go? There's stuff that could go, and it could be that excruciating thing of sitting in a darkened room and going, this is the bit that... Oh.
Yeah. No, wait.
Oh, hang on a minute.
I think you made a lovely point earlier, and maybe an important point in the context of this podcast, about how early this was in the development of the MCU and what a risk it was. We'd seen Iron Man. Iron Man could have gone wrong 50 different ways, but it didn't. Yeah. Captain America, I mean, a guy in Stars and Stripes, for God's sake, could have gone wrong. Like that 70s movies you remember, that was not a good movie. Could have gone wrong in 100 different
no
ways.
Offense.
Of my taste as a kid.
Yeah.
And, I mean, masterpiece. Thor could have gone wrong 50 different ways. And they just step by step built this thing, this continuity that's gone on for, you know, years and years now.
Yeah.
But you were there at the start of it, and it was all risky and it was all unknown. And I just, it's hard to cast your mind back to that, but I went into every Marvel movie as a Marvel fan saying, God, I hope they don't screw this up. And for movie after movie after movie, they didn't. And I thought it was just wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a thrill to be a part of it. And so early on in that journey, and to be a part of what did turn into a huge sort of shift in, well, just this hugely, hugely successful decade and a half, you know, however long it's been. But they, every time, as you say, they got it right. And they took, and, you know, they were bold, I mean, and brave with their Iron Man. I guess Robert Downey Jr. wasn't the you know, he'd peaked, he'd fallen out of, you know, he'd had his problems and was sort of fighting his way back, and to cast him in that role is potentially a risk, but they saw that is absolutely the person. You can't imagine anyone else doing it, you know, but it still must have been a risk. There still must have been discussions about, well, he's, you know, he's not an A-lister now. Do we need someone? And to have the confidence in the IP and the confidence in their vision of it, you know, most of the lead characters weren't huge stars at the time. They've all become huge stars. They had careers, but not, you know, not the level they're at now.
Chris Evans, Joe said that they were really worried that he wasn't going to take it because he had such a bad experience being in Fantastic Four. He said he didn't want to be part of the whole thing. And then getting him in, I mean, who else could be, you know, that Captain America? He just, he was Steve Rogers. Just a beautiful film all around.
But before we leave, Lex, and I don't want to derail my co-hosts, but I'd love to hear sort of a overview of your career. You mentioned K-19, The Widowmaker, which was 2002, was your first big movie. You did Captain America. What did you do in between, and what have you done since?
I spent the first, how long have I been doing it now, but I spent the sort of first 15 years of my career doing, I do a movie or some telly, and I do theater, and I did a lot of theater. And actually after Thunderbirds, I went to the Royal Shakespeare Company and spent 2.5 years just doing plays there. And it's a period of time I'm extremely fond of and extremely proud of the work that I did there. But when I look back, I go, well, that was quite a strange sort of, you know, move to make when you'd been doing all right, doing movies and doing. But I guess because of how I was brought up, you know, my dad was a big theater actor as well as the movies.
Yeah.
And the TV, he was a formidable and highly respected stage actor. And when I was growing up, I spent a lot of time at the Royal Shakespeare Company watching my dad. One of the early memories of thinking, oh, maybe this is something I want to do, was seeing my dad on stage in a production of Sophocles' Oedipus, him playing Creon, you know, crawling across the stage, screaming at the gods. And it was like quite a big thing to take on as his 12-year-old son at the time or whatever. But I was sort of so impressed by it and the experience of being in a theater. And then parallel to that, I had my grandmother's experience, but my grandmother on my mum's side, and I grew up watching
her movies from this sort of golden era of Hollywood, which an era that I loved. So my fascination and love of both areas I sort of took on with my career. And it so often is the case, unless unless you're at a certain level, a lot of it is what's offered to you, what's going to come your way. What and you go, okay, I could say no to this and hold out for what? If that seems an attractive prospect, just do it. And I love the sort of diversity of my career for that. And I kind of I feel pleased with those decisions that I made.
Do you have
That's
a
a
favorite Shakespearean role?
yeah, I do. Hotspur
Oh,
in
okay, yeah.
Henry the Fourth Part One, and that was a real highlight of my stage career. But I played Romeo quite early on. The second play I did, I played Romeo opposite Emily Blunt,
Wow,
oh, lovely.
who worked with Joe Johnson just before Captain America on The Wolfman.
Wolfman, yeah. And so, same thing with Hugo Weaving.
Oh God, yeah, of course. But and that was an amazing experience to see. It was clear what her trajectory would be, because she was so brilliant and so confident. And but it's I love both. I love both disciplines. I love Shakespeare. And then film-wise, it feels like it's changed. Like there were a lot of these early opportunities in the big film. In recent years, it's mainly been TV, with streamers and stuff. It's mainly telly, which I also enjoy. It's a different thing, the long form where you're carrying a character. If you're a regular in something, you're carrying a character on a journey through six, eight episodes of telly, and that's a hugely satisfying thing as well. Rather than being a sort of there's only so much you can get into a 90-minute, 2-hour movie, of course. But there's something about, we were saying film director's medium, stage actor's medium, and I think they say that TV's the writer's medium, because they what you find in a long ongoing show, once you started shooting, the writers do start writing for you, and that's a hugely satisfying process.
Yeah, I know it's I and if you're the person that they've been looking for on a TV thing, you can wind up for years on that show. So I have a friend who's in a Guy Ritchie show, and
Oh,
he
the
started out
gentleman.
yeah he
Was it the
started out with a
gentleman?
small part, and it just gets bigger and bigger as time goes by. So that's one of those, it's not Shakespeare, but it'll pay the rent. So it's
It'll pay the rent, and I do think there's amazing writers out there that, and it allows for a depth to the characters. If you if your character is allowed to sort of live through 8 episodes of TV, they could afford to be very three-dimensional and go on journeys within the overriding arc of the story, and they'll have these little sort of journeys within that. And it's a satisfying thing. And of course, a long ongoing series does indeed pay the bills, which is something which theater certainly doesn't.
Oh, it's nice, yeah.
Episodic fiction is a different creature. It occurs to me that there's a connection between comic books and television shows in that sense, and that any given issue or even any given episode, 30 minutes or 60 minutes, may not be that deep or interesting, but over the course of 40 or 50 or 60 or 100 issues or episodes, you can do some real in-depth character work that you can't do, as you said earlier, in a 90 or 120 minute movie.
And it's about detail, isn't it? You can have time for bits of detail and nuance that don't necessarily register so much at that point, but in the larger arc of it. I mean, and listen, when you look at shows like Breaking Bad, when what's the famous episode where there's just a fly in a room, isn't
Yeah,
it? The fly,
the
and you
fly in the
go,
lab,
I mean,
the
it's genius.
contamination, yeah.
Yeah. It's
Yeah,
genius.
it's it.
And hugely sort of playful, and writers must love that. They must love being afforded that screen time.
Wow. Well, Lex, really appreciate having you on the show. These are the kind of episodes we always say, this is the best episode ever, but this really is. I mean,
Oh, thank you,
we
guys.
enjoy hearing about this part of the business, and it's great being able to connect with you again. And just to say thank you for entertaining us for all
Here,
these
here.
years. I mean, you're
Oh, not at all.
yeah you know you're up you're just a press of a button away on Disney, or somebody owns a DVD on a shelf somewhere. There's probably kids in a campsite somewhere watching your movie on an iPad, and you continue to entertain, years on. So, but thank you very
Well,
much for being a part of
that's
it.
so good to hear, and thank you. And I love it. I love what I do.
Wow.
And I enjoy talking about it with guys like you. I've really enjoyed the conversation. So.
Thank you
thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I also like to thank our audience. If you'd like to continue our conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at our podcast streaming service, whatever podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check on our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.